So are you feeling good about how the Strieber piece is coming along and the conversations you're getting out of it?
Yeah, I've been enjoying it, and I feel like it's bearing fruit, if that's the right expression, that things are coming from it. I'm kind of not really. I mean, I started this without knowing exactly why I was doing it, and so I'm still not entirely sure why I'm doing it, but it just does seem to be an organic process that's leading to kind of new discoveries and new insights, and so that's the process so far. How about yourself?
I'm enjoying talking to you on a more regular basis, and and reading your book. And I do definitely feel like I'm able to take my own obsessions and bring them to this conversation, and that it fits. It doesn't entirely, it's not completely alien to what you're doing.
Well, yeah, I would guess that's the reason that you're here. Like you wouldn't be doing it otherwise, right?
No, of course not. But I mean, it's surprisingly easy to talk about these things, which I don't normally talk about, like with the
Yeah.
Strieber. And
Yeah. Well, that's surprising to me. It is surprising that you was so engaged in this subject matter, because it does seem so far from your usual hunting ground.
Well, I spent a lot of time on it in my 20s,
Yeah.
I did. I have no knowledge about whether or not Whitley Strieber was actually abused as a child, or whether satanic ritual abuse or CIA programs to abuse children exist.
Well,
You
we
know,
have
I
no
mean,
guess about whether aliens exist either, or so.
right. But I do know that child abuse exists, and I don't doubt that CIA programs of mind control have ended up abusing children. Whether or not there's a program aimed at child abuse is another question. But what I can talk about in terms of all that is just my understanding of what Freud would say trauma is, and whether or not that should be correlated to abuse, and whether abuse has to even be present in order for trauma to exist, and that kind of thing. The cases that Freud talks about don't involve, he thought at first they involved real abuse, and then he backed away from
Well,
that.
there's a lot of controversy there, though. I was just reading about that. I mean, as to why he backed away from it, it may not have had anything to do with him deciding it wasn't real, but simply peer pressure, or not simply, but the degree of peer pressure. I mean, for example, Freud dismissed the one case of a child being abused by her father simply because it was unthinkable to him. It wasn't based on any evidence. He just said, "Oh, well, that must have been a fantasy, because a father would never abuse her daughter." So that's very different from how we know things to be now, I think. And if you're on the edge like that as a pioneer, I don't think we have any business criticizing Freud, even if he did back away from the truth from peer pressure, because we've no idea what it was like back then.
There's that side of the story, and I don't know the particular case you're talking about, but there's also this other side, which is that he came to realize that the fantasies what he had, this theory of seduction, that didn't require for there to have been actual instances of sexual contact in order for these things to develop,
Yeah.
and that his theory changed as well. And I tend to believe that the theory changed for good reasons, even if he sometimes overlooked real cases of abuse for bad reasons.
I have that feeling too, actually, that we underestimate the power of the psyche again, and a fantasy with a PH, as in, generated internal imagery. And the psychic element of abuse, that a child can be traumatized. I think abuse is a loaded term. I'd rather not use it unless I have to. But a child can be traumatized by a form of psychic interference, which involves the adult's fantasy getting discharged into the child's psyche. I don't know if that's how Freud ever talked about it. I think he talked about the child actually generating its own fantasies as a way to make sense out of what was happening. But I think that it would be very hard to distinguish those two things, particularly if you're talking about an infant that is receiving this psychic material from an adult that is close to it, particularly a caregiver, and particularly if that adult is imposing its desire on the infant in some way, or its rage. I think that material gets transferred, and then that can do this very, can have this profound impact that's traumatic, and then that becomes internalized as a form of fantasy, but a self-harming fantasy, perhaps.
Right. Well, I think that the distinction between abuse and trauma is worth holding in mind, and not using the term abuse as synonymous with trauma is a good idea, precisely for the reasons that you just mentioned, but also because the trauma that a child experiences may not come from even ill intent or bad behavior on the part of a parent, or a part of a caregiver, or even a friend, or what have you, that you can be traumatized, that you probably will be traumatized just through experience. And like another example of this is like with allegations of rape, you don't want to make any time there are negative or bad feelings after a sexual experience into rape, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to say this constitutes rape just because during or after sex someone comes to regret the experience.
Right.
And I think that's, there are forces right now that are wanting to pretend like that's what should be the definition. No one actually believes that, but there are forces that like pretend that that should be the definition. Like in the Julian Assange case,
mm-hmm.
The two women who came to regret several days after having sex with Julian Assange ever having done so. And then that became the basis of rape charges. And so you don't want to lighten the load of abuse, but then it does become, or you don't want to just call anything abuse or anything rape. On the other hand, if you accept that trauma and bad feelings and misunderstandings are always going to be present and, an experience, and then with sex especially, there's always going to be an imbalance of power
mm-hmm.
in any sexual encounter. So, if you accept that there always is going to be an imbalance of power in any sexual relation, it becomes very tricky to define rape. Right?
Yeah. And even more so with abuse, as you say.
Yeah. So,
If a person feels traumatized, they're likely to feel abused. And if they feel abused, then they have to identify abuse.
Right.
And it becomes really complex if there was an early trauma. So there's an internalized agency of self-trauma going on, and so then a person will constantly feel abused, used and abused everywhere they go.
Right. And then on the other hand, here's the tricky thing. You can be someone who has not a lot of self-regard and accept abusive behavior. More easily too, and tend to towards self-blame when you ought not to. And those are like the two contradictory consequences of trauma or abuse. But I don't know if there are any good or easy answers to any of it. But you want to do neither thing. You don't want to say, "Oh, well, I'm always being treated fairly, and it's always my fault." Nor do you want to say, "Oh, that person was completely, I didn't get the promotion and therefore I was abused." Or...
Sweet dreams are made of these. Who am I to disagree? Travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody.
So, wow, I read it and I thought it was very interesting, and I'm kind of troubled by it.
When you say it, you
the chapter 8, your rewrite, A Wound in the Soul.
Yes, it left you troubled.
Well, it left me troubled in this way. I feel as though you've got to land, or we've got to land in this conversation maybe, on some kind of position about what Whitley Strieber experienced, that we can't just leave that question completely behind, that there's this kind of balancing act between treating him as though he's having a psychotic episode, and then this other side, which is like maybe he's a victim of satanic ritual abuse, maybe there were aliens, but I feel like we've got to, on some level or another, at least mark a spot where we stand in relationship to his work. Just what is he reporting? What do we think he's reporting? Maybe we can move it. Maybe we can be convinced otherwise, but I think it's a good idea to kind of start, or for me anyway, in this conversation, to try to come up with a position about this guy. But what's yours?
Well,
what
do you... let me ask you first something, okay. Then. having read what you've read, 8 chapters, so that's 2/3 of the whole piece now. Or the first part of the whole piece, I should say. How much, or to what degree, has your sense of Strieber's experience and what may or may not have happened been changed by what you've read? And what did you believe before, and what do you believe now?
I think that before, I allowed myself not to fully formulate a belief about what happened to him, to kind of allow myself, on the one hand, to think that he wasn't lying, or that he was not crazy, but on the other hand, that I didn't know what happened to him. And I think I think that might be an okay position, mm-hmm. but it was one where I left open the possibility that there was some answer that someone could find to describe what happened to him. And you know, that I just didn't happen to have that knowledge, but it was out there. And then there's the other possibility, which I'm coming to want to embrace, is that something happened to him that is, by definition, unreal. Like, it's like, the reason why it doesn't fit is because it's not, it's closer to the level of dream, but I don't want to put it on him. I don't want to say he was having a psychotic break, or he was, you know, hallucinating. But rather that the thing that happened was unreal.
Well, hold on though. When you say unreal, would non-physical be an alternate word for that?
It would be an alternate word, but I don't know if that's what I mean, because I think when we say non-physical, we actually often will be talking about something that we take to be entirely physical, or we treat as though it's physical, only it's invisible, only it's removed, like the concept of God or the concept of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we think about what it is to have a soul, we think about something that is basically an invisible physical thing. You know, that's why we can have ghosts.
An invisible physical thing.
Yeah, something invisible, maybe, that can do magical things, but it's physical. It's empirical. It can be seen. It can be heard. It can be experienced.
The soul can be seen and heard.
I think that we most of the time think of it that way. Yeah, because we think of it as something that might have an existence after death, in some form or another, and that it, you know, that it's the foundation of, like, the idea of a ghost. That, you know, it's like a version of you that you can think of the see it on television, you know, like the soul comes out of the by double exposure, the person seems to come out of his own body and walk around. That's the outer body experience is describes that same thing where you have an astral body and you're walking around with that.
All right, well, I don't want to get maybe sidetracked
Sorry.
into that, but I mean, when you were saying using the term unreal, as I think I've put forward various times in this piece and other times as well, like the reality of the psyche is, well, I would say it's undeniable, but it's not the same as the reality of nuts and bolts physical existence. Like we can't see or touch or smell or taste the psyche. Of course, that is another word for the soul anyway, but we see its effects everywhere. So if something is real to us at a psychological level, doesn't that make it real? I mean, this is what I'm getting to with what you're saying about Strieber's experiences. If they are real to him psychologically, then who are we to put the label of unreal onto them?
I think by saying they're real to him, from my perspective, if you say they're real to him, what you're saying is they're entirely subjective. And we have ideas or concepts that describe that. Like an hallucination is real to you, but it's not, it doesn't have any substantiality outside of your own mind.
What if there are somatic effects, though? Like I think I touched on in one of the recent chapters, chapter six, maybe, that as you know, overlapping with stigmata and what have you. And if an experience is so real to the person at a psychic or psychological level that it has physical manifestations, then what's going on at that point?
Well, you're still talking about a closed system. You're saying, I mean, I could almost view the hallucination as an epiphenomena of that physical process of developing the stigmata. You know, like you, like if you have you've got some sort of issue where you're developing wounds in your hands and feet, and some sort of physical process there. Maybe it's an infection of some kind, and that brings on through high fever an hallucination and a feeling of being like the Christ. I can turn it around and say the physical fact brings on a subjective experience. But the other thing that I can say is that the subjectivity is actually physical. Like you have a mental process going on, a set of neurological synapses, you know, making their electrical charges or whatever, however you want to describe that in real terms. And that could then have a feedback effect on the rest of the body. It still doesn't mean that there is, like if you're hearing a voice, that there's someone on the other side of that voice.
No, but
Yeah.
I guess what I'd be getting at here, if anything, is how, if we allow that that can happen at an individual level, how can we be sure it's not happening collectively?
Right. Well,
You
let's
know,
stop there for a second and talk about what that would mean for it to happen collectively. I mean, obviously, on some level or another, it has to be happening collectively because we like we're sitting here talking. Yeah, there we go. And so that's like that itself is a matter of the psyche. That's a shared ex the shared subjective experience of meaning. So yeah. So we definitely have the ability to share these kind of unreal things. But the reason why I want to say it's unreal instead of spiritual is because I want to underline how kind of strange the experience is, not to dismiss it. So I don't want to call it a hallucination. It's like it is unreal. There's something, it's like a, I don't know, it's like a puncture in what we take to be positive reality. But
Well,
that doesn't,
You say
Go ahead.
we though, but of course there's a large spectrum there in terms of what each of us take as reality, even though we might all agree on a large number of things, like a mountain is a mountain and up is up and down is down, and what color red is, a lot of that's presumption because we don't know what the other person's seeing. But beyond that, there is this large spectrum where some people allow for certain aspects or elements to be part of reality, and others don't, such as the soul being a very obvious example, or God being the ultimate kind of thing that people are divided on.
Right. There
And
is a big.
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well,
Go
as
ahead.
you say, if you could take a very hard and fast Christian, and they wouldn't even consider that the idea of God as an article of faith or belief. They would tell you that they know. Well, even Jung said that, didn't he? He said, well, at a certain point, it's not about belief, you just know. So.
Well, right. Okay. I see what you're saying, but. You can still have the possibility with someone who says they know what God is to interrogate them, that they know God's real, and see what it is that they actually believe. You know, like have it come out step by step and see if what they say they know is something that they can know. I think like my feeling is that that what it is to be real can be defined in a certain kind of way, and we don't have to, and then we can measure whether someone's belief against it. You know, we could say, you know, what it is to be real is that it's objective, meaning it's not only within the sub someone's subjective mind, that it there's the first step. Then the second step would be for reality, for something to be real. You might even go further and say that it would have to be re necessary to be truly the real, but
Necessary to what or to
or
who?
maybe to call it the truth. Necessary in and of itself, not to someone else, but that it is required, that it cannot not be.
Cannot
That
not
would,
be, but
yeah.
there has to be a somebody or something that it is necessary to, surely, otherwise it's in a vacuum.
Well, that's what you're trying to discover, that it, so that it isn't in that set of that kind of relationship where it isn't, because once you say, oh, well, it has to be real or necessary for someone else, then you have to ask, well, is that someone else either real or necessary? And then, you know, it just is an endless chain of justification. So what you're looking for is like something real, that is self-supporting, that doesn't have to have someone else, some other experiencer behind it. And maybe we can't find that. Maybe that's that kind of positive reality is impossible. And I kind of think it probably is, but I don't know what that would mean exactly. It might mean that there's some sort of reality to unreality that we hadn't considered before. Because if
So
that, go ahead.
you're talking about the objective reality, not this reality that's necessary to itself and doesn't need to be supported from the outside. And that, I mean, I don't necessarily want to get pulled into this kind of question to end all questions, because it is the question that can't be answered by definition. But yeah, is objective reality possible? And if even if it is, how would we ever know that? That seems to be a sort of, well, axiomatic, really, is that you can't ever know objective reality, because if you did, then it would have a subject.
Right. And so it's a problem trying to, I mean, it seems necessary that true objective reality could never be known. So, and yet that means then that we found an objective necessary fact that doesn't require a subjectivity, which is the fact that reality does actually always require a subject and an object both. that fact seems necessary. It doesn't seem to require a subject to verify it.
Okay, but isn't it a sort of intellectual hypothesis or model?
Right. Yeah, I guess
rather than the actual living experience, as compared to, let's say, Whitley's aliens or Whitley's visitors, whatever that is, however necessary or unnecessary, we're talking about a living experience, unless we consider that he might be making it up. But I don't really allow for that one.
Okay. This is, wait, see, I allow for the fact that he could be hallucinating or he could be making it up even, right?
Well, I'd say, I mean, I want to allow for everything, so I should take that back. I will allow for it, but I don't really find it that interesting or compelling, or the evidence does not support it, in my opinion.
But in the thing, okay, that may be, we'll come back to that in a second, but you said something else that was interesting, which was that the idea that every thing requires, like every subject requires an object and every object requires a subject, that philosophical thing notion I was tossing out there, you say, well, that's intellectual, and it obviously it requires someone to formulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the creatures in Strieber's case, which were not so clearly intellectual. But I think one of the things that's coming out of reading your book is that their nature changes as the ideas that Strieber puts forward about them changes. And that they are, if not always, kind of propositions. They're always these, they're both theoretical entities and real entities, maybe, or substantial entities. They represent things. They aren't, you know, you're fitting them into an intellectual system, into a Freudian system.
Absolutely. Well, of course, this is part of the dilemma, is that what we're talking about here and what I'm writing about is, it's impossible to separate Strieber's interpretation of the phenomenon from the phenomenon itself. To the extent we don't even know if it's fiction or non-fiction. All we have are his stories.
Right, yeah.
Which is partly why I try to bring my own story in there, because then I'm at least talking about my objective reality. I mean, that my subjective reality is my objective reality, right? It's the object that I'm dealing with, my body.
So with Whitley Strieber, I want to land and say, look, what this guy experienced is, if he experienced something other than hallucination or a concoction, you know, a lie, if he experienced something that had some sort of objective reality, mm-hmm. it had a kind of objective reality that was very peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of undermines itself.
Or undermines any interpretations of it. Which
right.
Isn't necessarily the same thing. If part of the purpose of this reality is to pull the rug out from under our interpretation systems.
Well, right. That's what I have trouble with, is the idea that this experience has a purpose. Like there's a conscious being really behind it, or if there is, what kind of conscious being is it? You know.
Well, what about the psyche? What if Strieber is interacting with his psyche, and that's the end of it? That's also the beginning of it. But I mean, in terms of just landing, if we can just temporarily, let's say, agree on that. And it's a very okay. wide definition. You could even say it's so wide it's no definition at all. But just say anyway, it's just experimentally, then the psyche is conscious. The psyche is beyond the understanding or the possibility of interpreting of the conscious mind. And it has a specific purpose, which is wholeness, integration.
Okay, well, let's stop there for a minute. I'll agree not to ask this other question anymore about whether it's objective or subjective, and grant you the idea of the psyche that isn't limited to being just subjective, right? It could be a collective psyche, right?
Yeah, right,
But
exactly.
we don't know whether it is or not, but we'll just say we'll call it the psyche, and we'll call it that makes it subjective, inside consciousness. So we won't worry about the subjective reality part. So, and then you were saying that its goal was wholeness. Do you think that he has in the culture become something like a representative of these aliens himself? That do you think does he think of himself that way as someone who's bringing their, like the old contactees, bringing their message to humanity? Kind of being a representative of them.
He does. I mean, he's described himself that way. Also, perhaps more, I don't know, more obviously, more pertinently, from the early days when he had the cabin and people would come and have the experiences themselves, or at least they would end up believing they had, up to the present, I think, where he does these meditation groups and I don't know what else, and he will, it's on one of the audios on Crucial Fictions, him talking about this, he will not promise, but at least give the hope that people will have a contact experience if they hang around long enough. So yeah, very much the ambassador, really, of the other world.
Well, that I tell you that fact that the idea that he's promising that and charging for it makes pushes me to think he's a charlatan again because anytime that you look if you really have an experience which you can get access to at will, like that, then it's your kind of it's your responsibility if it's something as otherworldly as this to examine it and test it and come to some sort of conclusion about it that's based on as something as close to science as you can get, the very best of kind of examination that you can get, rather than mystifying it and selling it off as a religious experience. I mean, if he could really.
First of all, he's not guaranteeing it, and then the audio in question, he even says something about how knowing the Greys, they probably won't show up just because they know I want them to. So he's very much announcing the fact that he has no control over it, and even kind of turning it upside down. So that's one thing. As far as I mean. I guess it's the whole question of what is a charlatan and what is not, I think, is the general question. But as far as the scientific versus the religious approach, I'm pretty sure that Strieber himself would insist that he's taking a scientific approach to this, even though you and I would probably agree that it's really not that scientific and that it has all the earmarks of religiosity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how you could justify calling it scientific. If he was getting a crew of, scientists in to document and test and somehow, establish,
Yeah, but we know that they don't show up when you bring your cameras, right? So
right. Well, then I wonder why that is. I'm just, I mean, I can accept that they don't show up except when you're not prepared, but then you can't, I don't know. I start to feel duped. I mean, I have a friend who went to a UFO retreat and says he saw, the UFOs in the skies using night vision goggles, and I just and they, he paid like $300 to go to on this retreat, and see the UFOs. And I was like, well, if there are flying saucers in this area so regularly that every weekend you can go up and see them, then, you know, they really ought to, and tell SETI, you know, put your dish here because they're coming every week and, you know, like clockwork. So,
Well, I mean, my feeling about that was if that's true, then they're probably not, they're probably human. They're probably some sort of human technology. That would just be my
well, right.
somewhat informed but mostly gut reaction to that. And
Yeah.
it could be, you know, that these Stephen Greer and these guys who are doing this quasi-scientific New Age movement to welcome the Space Brothers and channel the Space Brothers, that wittingly or not, that they're part of some intelligence program that knows when a bunch of these scientistic hippies go up to the desert to greet the Space Brothers or for a show, then they deploy their secret technology and give them a show. I don't find that far-fetched myself at all, you know, because
No.
the
And
implication, yeah.
also with a little bit of conditioning, a smaller show can seem much bigger than it is. You
Sure,
know.
of course.
Yeah.
If you've got your expectations all pumped up, then you're doing half the work at least yourself, I think, at that point.
Right. So anyways, but see now I'm being extremely skeptical, and seeming like much more hard-nosed than I am. I mean, I'm willing to accept that it's possible that, you know, something is going on, but it may be something much closer to this tribal ritual than we know. Like one thing I was going to kind of lead up to was that if well, let's say that if there are aliens that they're like Whitley Strieber really is a good representative of them. Like, you know, like it's not like they're the secret power behind him, that he kind of is the human face for, but that they're just as kind of screwy as he is. You know, and they're kind of as fraudulent on some level or another as he is.
That's
Not
possible.
that they're Not that they're human beings, but although that's a good, you know, could go all the way to that. But maybe they're human, maybe they're not, maybe they're aliens. But maybe they don't quite know what they're doing, and maybe they think they represent somebody else. And you
Well,
know.
you were saying that it would be good if we could land, and then you asked right at the beginning, and I avoided it, like, what do I think? Which isn't necessarily clear in the piece because I'm trying to ask questions rather than give answers, and I want the reader to come to their own, not conclusions, because it never concludes, but just make their own interpretations. That maybe there's three things going on here that I would say. One is, Strieber's own psychological process, his own demonic complexes, his own trauma, his own fragmented psyche, his own neuroses, his own projections, all of that stuff that is very, you know, on the surface in the piece. It's the meat of it, I think. So that's number one. Number two would be that there's a human agency involved, or agencies, about which I won't maybe say any more because that's just a whole can of worms. We can go back to it. And then number three, my sense is that there is also this non-human presence that is, I wouldn't say alien except in the widest sense, as in unknown to us, that is a form of energy that I think is, I don't know about native to the earth, but certainly it is part of the earth. It is very closely connected to fairy lore and that whole realm of mythology, stroke, cultural or collective experience that goes back through history, and that's the real unknown. I think the number one is pretty unknown because we don't really understand the psyche and how powerful it is and how it works. Number two is unknown because we're talking about covert agencies, very secret practices, technologies, methods, all the rest of it, the whole MK Ultra, just that whole, can of worms. But number three is like really like the the almost completely unknown, in that it's really outside of even our terms or our language. We don't really even have the language maybe to talk about some sort of consciousness that is interacting with us that doesn't actually have any obvious physical source. So we can't say it's the birds or the bees or the humans or the extraterrestrials. It's just this unknown consciousness that's interacting with us. That's kind of where I stand on that. And I know that's not really, it probably doesn't sound much like ground, because it raises more questions than it answers, perhaps.
Well, no, it's ground enough for me, because it presents what your perspective is. I don't expect you to know the absolute reality, but just I want to know what you what your ideology is, what's your story. And it seems to me that that story is very close to being the orthodox story about Whitley Strieber. I don't think he would have a lot of trouble with it.
Well, there's a lot in my account, though, that isn't in his account, really. Because I don't
well,
he's allowing the possibility that he might actually be inducing hallucinations in people, that he might be an unconscious sorcerer that's conjuring these entities, or he might be conscious of it and just not talking about it. And he's definitely not talking about the process church and all of the, I think, quite very suggestive evidence that he's been being handled by human agencies, not just in his childhood, but throughout his adult life and probably to the present, I would say.
Okay. Well, we have to kind of pick this apart really carefully here, because if he thinks he has knowledge from the extraterrestrials and can give it to others, it may not surprise him that he would have psychic abilities that he got from his experience.
That's true.
So then he would, if he was passing something along, like a toper or bringing on hallucinations from his own consciousness in another person, that would in fact really support his alien hypothesis.
It would if you allowed that the experiences that were being induced in other people were objectively real. Once again, we're into this fuzzy area. But I know from what Strieber said, just as a footnote, he keeps insisting he's not saying they're extraterrestrials. But anyway, that he, I mean, one thing is consistent, like even from once he basically sort of massaged out the knots of doubt in those early couple of years, that he has consistently stated that these are a real, this is a real, this is real, folks. It's something outside of us, a real presence that is here from elsewhere. So that's the thing, is if you were to suggest that he is somehow summoning entities through the power of his own unconscious, and deploying them into people's lives like sorcerers have been known to do, I think that's very different from the idea that he's just made contact with these beings and that they're therefore people close to him are also being contacted.
Well, it depends on. Yeah, I don't. I do think there's a difference in like in the quality, in the kind of the feeling of those two stories, but it depends on whether basically the agency in the entities that he's summoning is more profound in the second case, where the aliens are contacting people he has contacted but on their own initiative, whereas if he's a sorcerer, then he's the entities that he's creating are really almost puppets.
Mm-hmm. Allies would be in the Castaneda model, you see. I mean, this is not something I've written about in the pieces, you know, but it's just sort of coming up more and more in these conversations, and this idea does seem to be growing, coming into more clear focus, that that Strieber may be the author of his own experiences, but not in the way that the more cynical or materialistic mind would have it, but in a much more profound and perhaps also more disturbing sense that he has accessed some alien quote unquote energy consciousness, and as a writer he's managed to kind of frame it and pin it down and put handles on it to the extent that he can now have a certain degree of control over it. And he himself has indicated this indirectly, like with his von Neumann hypothesis that the visitors need our belief to become real, and therefore he has this ambivalence because he's actually therefore helping them to become real by presenting them to the world in a convincing way so that more and more people believe in them. And in his novel 2012, The War of Souls, he put himself into the novel as a fictional character with the same initials. Simultaneously, the alien beings in 2012 are horrendously malevolent, soul-devouring entities who also need belief in order to have ingress into our world. It's very Lovecraftian. I even have an audio I listened to recently where he refers to them as the old ones, not in some dramatic sense. Like it's just more like a slip of the tongue. He says these old ones have knowledge that we don't have, or something like that. But nonetheless,
yeah.
Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there.
Well, yeah, that's it's the idea that he is his, the creator of his own, the author of his own experience, is a fascinating idea, and it reminded me of something that I've been thinking about in my little realm, which is about, you know, the nature of social reality, and whether or not such a thing exists. And I was watching one of my old heroes, Noam Chomsky, talk about how he dislikes French intellectuals because they have these ludicrous notions. And one of them was that reality is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
That it's social, that what we think of as real is really a social construction. And here's one of the reasons why Noam Chomsky rejects that idea, is because there was a scientific study done on a mummy in the, I think it was the 80s, and they determined that the pharaoh, the prince king, or the boy king, I should say, not the, it's either a prince or a king, but the boy king, had died of what we would call tuberculosis. And there was a philosopher in France who read this report and objected strenuously to the notion that we could say that this pharaoh had died of tuberculosis, because tuberculosis was a social construction and didn't have any existence when the pharaoh was alive. It didn't exist then. So it couldn't have been that tuberculosis killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I have not read, the philosopher's name who made that objection was named Latour, and I have not read his actual essay or work where he made that claim. And I have the suspicion that it's much more complicated than what he actually said was more complicated than what I just said. But it does seem to me kind of ridiculous on its face to imagine that reality is socially constructed in that way, where we wouldn't be able to say that the pharaoh died of tuberculosis because they didn't know what tuberculosis was.
Well, isn't there a, I think there's a sort of flaw in that, like Chomsky's using the logic of constructed reality, of potentially constructed reality, to show that it couldn't be constructed. Right? Because, as I see it, like, socially constructed reality is synonymous with the ego. Not that they're identical, but that they're inseparable. Like,
right.
Society constructs the ego, and the ego constructs society. So it's your chicken or the egg question, really. They come into existence simultaneously. So if you're using the ego to try and unpack that idea or explore that idea of whether reality is constructed or not, then you're always going to win your own arguments, I think.
Well, I don't know if that... I'm not sure I agree with you there. I mean, I think that you can use reason, which maybe is aligned with the ego, to at least come up with a pretty good answer about this question. But maybe, I don't know. But here's what I thought about Chomsky and about Latour, is that if Latour is really right that the pharaoh... that reality is constructed, then he has to accept that when we say the pharaoh from ancient Egypt died of tuberculosis, that's reality, because reality is socially constructed, mm-hmm. and we're socially constructing that fact now.
Mm-hmm.
It means that there is no reality then. There was no reality but the socially constructed reality now, and that includes the past.
Well, not necessarily, though. Accepting the idea that there is a constructed reality isn't the same as accepting that there's no other reality beside what we construct.
Right, but you could, but you do have that possibility. I mean, that would be a solution, that would end up siding with Chomsky and still holding the notion of constructed reality.
What? I didn't follow that.
Okay. Chomsky's objection is that, of course, the pharaoh did have tuberculosis, even if the Egyptians didn't know it. Right? And that's because reality is not, because tuberculosis is real. And it existed then and exists now. Latour wants to act as though... there is a constructed reality in the past and a new constructed reality in the present. However, what you could do is to hold on to his idea of all reality being entirely constructed and still end up agreeing with Chomsky that the pharaoh did die of tuberculosis, and simply say there's all reality is constructed, and it's only the reality that exists in the moment. The true constructed reality of the present is what is real. And any attempt to understand the past and their constructions is always coming from what's right. real, which is the present constructed reality. So mm-hmm. that means that the pharaoh did die of tuberculosis.
In the present, anyway.
Well, as we understand what happened to him in the present.
Until we have a new idea of what tuberculosis means, or what pharaoh means, or what dying means.
Right. We could always come up with a better explanation later.
Or a different one.
Yeah. And that's the scientific approach, really, is that it's not to be wed to this notion of tuberculosis being a real entity for all of time,
mm-hmm.
but that that's the best explanation that there is we've come up with up to now as to explain that those symptoms.
Science, it seems to me, science doesn't really admit to that that degree of subjectivity or uncertainty. Though, as in, this is just a temporary model. We're just using it until something better comes along, and don't take it too seriously, folks. It seems to me that, not to state the obvious, but science is another face of religion, really, just a materialistic face of religion.
It can be. I don't think it has to be. I mean, the thing about science is that it has a very particular method. So it always, you know, is very, very dogmatic about that. Mm. To be true science, you have to have a control. You know, you have to, there's all, I'm not a scientist. I can't remember all the steps really, but you know, you have a hypothesis, you have a way of testing it. It has to be, to have a scientific hypothesis, it has to be something that you could possibly negate. You could possibly find it to be not true. There's all these things about what makes up a science. But it always, to be truly scientific, you know, the first rule there is that it could be not true, that the hypothesis, whatever it is, could be not proven to be not true.
Mm.
Even if there's been a lot of evidence, a lot of testing that shows something is true, there's always a possibility that new understanding, new tests will demonstrate it's not true. If not, if there's that is not a possibility, then you're not dealing with the scientific truth anymore. Because that's like built into the scientific truth, is that it has to be able to be negated, has to be able to be overcome.
Mm.
So,
well, science is synonymous for knowledge, right? I was just reading Nietzsche's quote that the original sin is science is the original sin, that thou shalt not know is the basis of all morality. And so for me personally, it occurred to me while we're having this conversation about science is that I don't really know very much at all, and again I'm falling back on cliche unfortunately, but like the more that I discover, the deeper I go into my experience, the less I'm sure of. So then, even though I'm becoming more and more I hope I'm becoming more and more rigorous with logic, appliance of logic, and what might be termed a scientific approach in a certain sense, in a very wide sense. How do I finish that thought? Just what I said already, really. It's not increasing my sense of certainty. It seems to be decreasing it.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the weird thing about science, is that it's a claim to knowledge that always has built into it the necessity for an admission of doubt, an admission of not knowing.
Mm.
Because it, as I said, you know, the main thing about the first thing I think of anyway about a scientific hypothesis is that you have to be able to imagine or come up with a way to disprove it for it to be scientific.
Right. Absolutely.
And so, you know, that means that you're always holding off from absolute certainty when it comes to scientific knowledge.
Right. If it's good science, then you can't allow for dogma. Which is another word for certainty.
Right. Well, it's not, I mean, I think that there could be a certainty that is not merely a dogma. Yeah. That's an actual certainty, but it wouldn't be scientific.
What would it be then?
I'm tempted to say it would be philosophical.
Or religious?
No, that's a side on dogma. That's a dogma. It's a religious dogma. Because the religion is based on, seems to me to be based on faith and feeling. Whereas philosophical certainty would be based on logic.
You're right. So that's mind as opposed to so-called mind. I was tweeting yesterday that it seems ironic that people who never question the reality of mind are dismissive about the idea of the soul, when they seem to be both equally based on faith. The idea of mind and the idea of soul they're equally immaterial.
Yeah, that's true. They are equally immaterial.
So we only know them by their effects, really. We can say that mind exists because this and that couldn't come about without mind, but you could also just substitute the word soul for that if you wanted, right?
I think the difference, from the way I'm looking at it, the difference between a mind and a soul is that the mind is something that doesn't exist independently of the body, but is almost a negation of it, or it's like a and the thing that is missing that allows the body to have the a space to exist in. Like we, it's the realm in which our experiences happen, is the mind. But our experiences are of the body. And whereas the soul is almost like a body, another body that just gets to live on after we die.
Well, that, I mean, that's one interpretation of it. But
yeah.
You could speak to 10 different people and they'd have 10 different versions of what the mind is also. Like I would say the mind is a collection of thoughts, really, like an itinerary. It's like a menu, like in the Terminator movie where he's on the telephone and he chooses between go away, I'm busy, and fuck you, asshole. That's kind of how I experience the mind. when something new comes up, I don't see that as coming from the mind. I see that as coming, well, from the soul, I guess. But even put a question mark after that, I don't actually know where it comes from, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't come from the mind, because I don't see the mind as having any real existence outside of thought.
Yeah. Well, what about just the perception that you're having right now of say sitting at your computer? Is that happening in your mind?
I'm actually on my couch because I approach these conversations like therapy also. But anyway, well, it's funny because I was just writing about that today down at the lake, that consciousness of a, what did I write? That the thought I'm hungry is not an expression of hunger. It's just an interpretation of something that's happening. So what you just described, the thought that I'm sitting on the couch, lying on the couch, etc., etc., that's independent from the consciousness of actually this happening. That's just an interpretation that's being laid on top of it. So I'd say in a way it's the inverse of it, like it's the antithesis of the experience itself, thought.
Yeah, I think you're right. But that kind of goes back to what I was saying before, is that the mind is the negation of the body, that or the negative space around the body that allows the body to exist. Like the mind would be, if you're looking at a painting, the mind would be the background, and not even objects in the background, but the background itself or the canvas.
So, but see, where I'm not sure, like what you're talking about is, do you think of mind as thinking, as in a thought machine, or basically a compendium of thoughts, collection of thoughts, or are you referring to mind as consciousness?
Or, well, self-consciousness, I suppose. I think of it as one side of a process of consciousness. Like you don't have a painting if you don't have objects on the painting, on the canvas. You just have a blank canvas.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm wrong about the mind being like the canvas then, but it's you know, frankly, I get a little confused about what is mind, because
well, do you have a sense at any time, Doug, and I know you're not a religious man, neither am I, but I don't think you're not necessarily spiritually inclined, whereas, as you know, I am, but do you have a sense at any time that there's something in your experience that is eternal?
Yeah, well, I think so. Well, let's just stop and think about that for a second. There's no thing in my experience that's eternal, but it seems to me that the state of the subject, of being able to, of experience itself, it has to be eternal.
Right.
That, for I can't conceive of what it would mean for anything to exist if it wasn't existing in this relationship that I experience the world. If it wasn't existing as an experience, uh-huh, of some kind or another, that would seem to me like the idea of the universe without living things in it, and the idea of no universe, seems to me to be identical.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to look for something like God, it would be that infinite living experience that seems to be that I seem to be having or right. sharing in, but I wouldn't say that it is me.
You can't identify with it, right?
Right.
But that is the context, right? When we
that's
have
the context.
These concepts, call them philosophical, call them mathematical, what you like, call them poetic or religious, we have these concepts of the infinite and the eternal. And they are more than just concepts. I mean, they are kind of indisputable realities. There's no way, like you were talking about before, like something that exists in and unto itself that is necessary, not just as a hypothesis, but just as a reality. That to me would be the bedrock, what is infinite and what is eternal. And so that's the context for this conversation and for every experience that ever happens or ever can happen. Seems to me that is the context for it, that it is happening within the infinite, eternal something that is really nothing, however you want to... Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah.
Saying too much already there. All we know about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, the problem is always that you start to try to describe God and he, you know, or it starts to have these Brad Pitt characteristics.
Or Whitley Strieber.
Right, or Whitley Strieber characteristics. It's like it's just a fantasy. But the thing is, it's not the weird thing about what I've described is that it's this absence. It's this thing that I can't, it happens, but I can't get a hold of it. It, you know, why is there any meaning attached to these small mouth noises that I'm making? Why, if I'm only a brain firing synapses, who is this subject? And there are, it seems to me there are ways of saying that there really is no subject that are wrong. And there are ways of saying that there is no subject that are right. And like the materialists, the hardcore materialists say, oh, no, that there is no subject. It's just a mistake. you know, these are not being rational. They start to contradict themselves when they say that.
How about we bring it back to the amoeba under the microscope here, and which is Whitley.
Mm-hmm.
And as a question rather than a statement, maybe what he's doing, do you think, has to do with this need in us to personify or objectify the infinite and the eternal, to give it some sort of form so that we can interact with it?
I would say that he's doing that, but unconsciously so. He's doing it in an unconscious way. He's not aware of what... I mean, let me just... Let's step back and just talk about UFOs and flying saucers for a moment. If it were really physically, as we normally understand it, real, that there were people from other planets, aliens from other planets visiting Earth, it would very quickly become, I believe, like... it is in The Men in Black. Have you seen that movie? Those movies?
Yeah.
They're just a bunch of schmucks, you know, at the airport.
Yeah.
There's no mystical import to alien contact. It's kind of can be funny and adventurous even, but they're not, the aliens are no ambassadors. They're not ambassadors from God.
Mm-hmm.
They're just other living creatures, biology, somewhere else.
Right.
So the fact that we start to associate religious significance to these things is, I think, comes from our own religious impulses, which may go back to what we've been talking about, you know, the problem of existence. So anything that, but that doesn't mean that actually we aren't actually being contacted by aliens. It just means that you don't need them in order to end up with these spiritual questions. That doesn't help really us understand the spiritual or the philosophical questions.
No, it may be the inverse, I think. In that, like, if there's, like, the mind, it seems to me that the mind can't really get to grips with the infinite and the eternal. There's just no way. I think the body has no problem with that, because the body is just part of that system, which is part of, it's just part of the context. But the mind, as you're pointing out, can somehow negate and separate itself, and so it can never get to grips with what is infinitely larger than itself. It can only be absorbed by it. So it's as if, like, one way, and religion is this too, one way to somehow wrestle the infinite down into some form that it can have dominance over the mind, is to force it to embody, like, or to create a narrative, to become the author of its manifestation, in the way that, you have Jesus by the Coke machine, to use your previous analogy.
Right. Yeah.
And then you can see he's just another schmuck. This is what the mind wants. That's what we want, right?
Right, yeah.
So maybe that's, I mean, I'm sort of free riffing now, but in the last chapter 8, I just reread it myself, and what stood out to me the most was that juxtaposition between the rectal probe and the face of the visitor, who Strieber venerates so highly. And I suggested that he seemed to be unconsciously trying to debase this master that he worshipped. And so maybe that is a very basic sort of mechanism or unconscious drive in all of us, but that's in evidence in Strieber's thing, is that he's actually unconsciously trying to debase the transcendental or the divine reality that is threatening to assimilate him or to destroy him in some way.
Well, how do you view the human actors around him, his handlers, within that story?
Well, yeah, that would probably be a direct match, because if you think of MK Ultra and these programs attempting to harness psychic powers and to traumatize infants in order to maybe open a portal into these other realms and learn to control whatever energies or beings reside in those realms, that's very Lovecraftian in itself, whatever they may or may not believe they're doing and may even be doing for all we know, doesn't that all kind of come under the banner, along with the Hadron Collider and everything else that I write about, of hubris, which is the attempt to supplant the divine, to defy the gods.
Right. But it's only hubris if you think that there are versions of, you know, the kind of experiencing being that you are that are, you know, fully embodied instantiations of this experience that you can have of the infinite. And I guess my perspective is that infinite experience can only be really comprehended as an abstraction. It cannot be embodied in any way other than Jesus by the Coke machine. That way, that's where you always end up. And that what that means is that that actually leaves strangely room for progress, and that, you know, we can maybe more fully embrace the power, because there's no one out there whose will we're violating by trying to understand more. Right. There's no God up there who's saying, no, Icarus, stay away from the fire. That's not happening. You know, we can play with the fire and we'll get burned. You know, we'll always end up getting burned, but at the end, maybe we can cook our meals. I don't know.
So then it's a self-traumatizing thing. It's a self-harm. Like, the hubris is against one's own psyche, one's own authentic nature. Let's say one is defying it unconsciously because one feels threatened by it unconsciously. And so, yeah, the only punishment that happens is within our own psychic space and our own bodies, I would say.
Right. That's basically right. I think the other way I look at things is like like in terms of like trying to create a different social world, because I'm always on about that, is that we have to accept the idea that the next society that we're going to live in is going to be terrible and wholly new ways that we haven't even thought up yet. You know? And maybe, you know, it won't be terrible in so much as people starve, and it won't be terrible in so much as there'll be nuclear war, but it'd be more terrible in the way of like having someone slight you or having psychological games being played on you by your wife or something. It's like that kind of terribleness where you end up being feeling totally undermined at the end of the day. Like you don't even know who you are, but you're not going to end up getting shot or, you know, thrown into a mass grave.
I think we're seeing the sort of, I mean, I was saying this just yesterday, it seems like we're on the cusp, feels to me like we're on the cusp of the Matrix world coming into being, and actually the point where the technology we're developing and employing, and actually it's becoming obligatory with these Google goggles and all this stuff, is very manifestly invasive and intrusive. Like, I feel quite content with the level of technology. Okay, get back to me in 10 years. But it seems to me we've got everything we need really now in terms of technology. At this point, okay, it has been happening for decades, but I mean, it's really becoming manifest. I'd say now the technology is beginning to intrude upon us as individuals and as organisms in ways that are unmistakable, I would say.
Well, let's, I mean, I don't entirely disagree. But I wonder about the reason why technology is intrusive. And I would also say that it's probably always been felt that way. You know, that's certainly since maybe the World War I, that technology has been felt as this looming threat.
Well, sure. There was nuclear bombs, so that was kind of a bit different. And what we're talking about here is like at a very individual level that you can directly experience. Not that I have a job, but if I did, and my boss was telling me you have to wear these Google goggles from 9 till 5 so that we can monitor your every eye blink, I would definitely start. I mean, that's really, it is subjective, but it's at the same time, it's not subjective, right? That's empirical proof that technology is now invading our inner space.
Right. But I would just say that, you know, actually you don't need the Google goggles to do that. They've got tracking devices that can watch every movement. I mean, my friend's a mailman, and his boss does require him to carry around a GPS tracking device everywhere he goes while he's on the job.
Right. Well, that's just saying it has been going on for decades, but it does feel to me, maybe it's just my own subjective thing, but that it's just in these years that we're in now, it is becoming overtly manifest.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that again, like on a separate, like, yeah, maybe a podcast for Diet Soap instead of your thing.
Okay.
Because maybe we can come up with an essay to read about Google Glass or about this NSA, you know, wiretapping.
Yeah, that was the only thing I read, and I don't generally keep up with news, but it does directly overlap with where this Prisoner Infinity piece is going, with the transhumanism, the whole subject of transhumanism.
Right. I'm not sure. See, sometimes I feel like I'm actually like, when it comes to this conspiracy and transhumanism and all of that, like I'm the advocate. I secretly am maybe on their payroll, because I like some aspects of the transhumanist idea. You know, I'm not even that allergic to Google Glass as a concept. It doesn't seem that much worse than
end of the wedge.
but you know,
you acknowledge that we're, I don't know if evolving is the word, but the way that we're developing is, it does seem to be that we're developing ways to create more and more sophisticated kinds of problems.
Yeah. And also more sophisticated methods of control. And my problem with it is that the foundation of on which we this all is running is a foundation of inequality and injustice. So, you know, you're not going to have implements of control you're not going to develop tools that are liberating, put to liberating use. Coming out of this kind of society, it's always going to be turned around and used to kind of fuck the little guy and to make sure that you know. Yeah, the funny thing is, like with Google Glass, they monitor you for every second, but if something happens to you, like you get hit by a car or something, you're on your own. It's like, oh yeah, we're monitoring you down to the second. but oh, you know, it would cost money to take you to the hospital. So if you have your own private health insurance or whatever, then yeah, okay. But otherwise, forget it. So it's like so clearly just exploitation and no reward there. I guess unless you have a good credit card in which you can constantly be shopping through your eyeglasses or something. But who wants that?
But, right. Well, yeah, I think you're right. It's for a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. Take second best, put me to the test. Things on your chest, you need to confess. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone to care. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith.